Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 225th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and this episode is presented by the Prime Original series, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, from executive producers Amy Sherman-Palladino and Daniel Palladino, and starring Rachel Brosnahan, Alex Borstein, and Tony Shalhoub. Consider it marvelous in all categories, including outstanding comedy series. My guest today is one of her generation's most respected actresses, having shined on screens big and small for the last 25 years. She first burst onto the scene at the age of 14 as high school student Angela Chase on ABC's My So-Called Life, which ran from 1994 through 1995, and for which she was nominated for both an Emmy and a Golden Globe for Best Actress in a Drama Series. Over the ensuing years, she starred in films such as 1994's Little Women, 1996's Romeo and Juliet, 1997's The Rainmaker, 2002's Best Picture Oscar-nominated The Hours, and 2005's Shop Girl. But it was for her portrayal of an autistic livestock industry expert in an HBO TV movie, 2010's Temple Grandin, that she received her greatest acclaim to that point, winning an Emmy, a Golden Globe, and a SAG Award for Best Actress in a Miniseries or TV Movie. But it is with a part that she started playing a year after that she is, and may forever be, most closely associated. That of bipolar CIA officer Carrie Matheson on Showtime's Homeland, which recently wrapped its seventh season, and for which she has won two Emmys, two Golden Globes, a SAG Award, and a Critics' Choice TV Award for Best Actress in a Drama Series. I'm talking, of course, about the great Claire Danes. But first, I was joined at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter by Matt Bellany, our editorial director, to discuss a wild week on the business side of Hollywood, which could have major ramifications for the worlds of film and TV, and therefore for the Oscars and the Emmys. Matt, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
It has for some time now looked like all but a done deal, I think, that Disney would purchase most of 21st Century Fox's assets for $52.4 billion. But that now seems to be in jeopardy because of Comcast. What is going on here ahead of this, I guess, July 10th meeting where Fox shareholders are going to discuss their future?
Well, it's a bidding war, really. I mean, Comcast, which is a media company about the same size as Disney and very similar, they have theme parks, movies, television networks. Comcast has come in with a bid that is about 19-20% bigger than the Disney bid for Fox, and their bid is all cash, whereas the Disney bid is mostly stock. So this has essentially set off a war, and some analysts think that it could get to as high as $80 billion for these Fox assets. In this environment right now, where every media company is trying to get bigger to compete with the Facebooks and Netflixes and Googles and Amazons, these digital behemoths that can buy and sell what they want, these Fox assets, which is basically the film studio, the television studio, networks like FX, Nat Geo, it doesn't include Fox News, it doesn't include sports and the Fox Broadcast Network, but they're pretty significant assets, especially overseas, and that's where Comcast really has been weak. They want to own more overseas, and the Fox stuff could give them that. So it's really a battle for the future of these networks and studios.
And do you think, though, for Comcast, it's also sort of the reason they're coming into this so aggressively is from a defensive place, that they don't want to lose another major thing to Disney, which already has Pixar, Marvel, and Lucasfilm, and is just looking, you know, harder and harder to compete with?
Maybe. I mean, they're about the same size. There is a personal angle here in that the CEO of Comcast, Brian Roberts, has a big personal rivalry with Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney. They do not like each other. But they also see the future, and the future is in scale, and these are assets that don't come along very often. I mean, the Murdochs had for years and years never been interested in selling, and for whatever reason, maybe it's succession with his kids, maybe it's he sees the writing on the wall, he has now decided that this is something he wants to do. So they've really, it'd be irresponsible of them not to go for it.
And what's your gut tell you? Would Rupert Murdoch rather be one of Disney's biggest shareholders or get as much as he possibly can for 21st Century Fox?
Every indication we've seen is that Rupert would like a Disney deal. He sees that as a better home, and he sees Disney as a better shepherd for the assets. If you look at some of the synergies that might work well, I mean, Fox has the X-Men and Deadpool franchises, and Disney has Marvel, so that would make sense. There could be a Deadpool movie with Spider-Man or with Iron Man or something like that. But Comcast also has theme parks. So a lot of the Fox assets could go in those theme parks. You know, it's a really interesting battle. The award space could also be impacted here because there's a lot of speculation as to what Disney would do with something like Fox Searchlight, which has really been nurtured under the Murdochs and allowed to take big risks. And it's paid off with a number of Best Picture winners, most recently with Shape of Water.
Absolutely.
And would Disney be interested in an R-rated Fable that doesn't play by a lot of the same rules that the Disney movies play by? Everything that Bob Iger has said is that he wants to preserve that culture and the creativity, and I think a lot of the initiatives that Disney has, like a streaming service and other things, the Fox Searchlight movies would fit well within that, but for how long?
Right.
You know, and then you think about the Emmy race as well. FX has become such a huge player in the Emmy race and has really built their brand on these risk-taking and edgy series. I don't know if Disney would have the appetite for that. I gotta think they would. I think they wouldn't screw up that kind of brand.
Right.
But you never know. And, you know, Ryan Murphy, FX's biggest creator, and, you know, 20th Century Fox's biggest creator, he saw what was going on and he went to Netflix.
Right. And we are going to come to that in a second. But I guess in the meantime, the fact is that until this is resolved with either Disney or Comcast, a lot of people who work for Fox are kind of in limbo. And I'm sure it's not great for morale when you don't know what's going to happen with your future, right?
No, everybody we've spoken to, you know, is in this like waiting game, you know, especially the top executives where, you know, if you're running Fox, as Stacey Snyder is, the Fox Film Studio, you're pretty sure your job is not going to exist if either Comcast or Disney buys Fox, because they have their own film executive teams. And the Fox Studio will likely become a glorified label under those executives. And why would Stacey Snyder want to do that?
Right.
So, you know, that's led to a lot of uncertainty, but she can't really be out there campaigning for another job because she has to run the day-to-day of the studio, although, you know, under the radar, she probably is campaigning for another job. But, you know, the Fox Searchlight people, they're just doing what they do until they're told that they shouldn't anymore. Right. And would they be merged with Focus under Comcast? Mm-hmm. Focus Features is the prestige label under Universal. Mm-hmm. Maybe they would. Maybe it would be a separate label. Who knows?
So there are a lot of potential ramifications for the award sphere. Another big thing that's happened in the last week, a judge cleared the way for AT&T to buy Time Warner for $85.4 billion. Why was this purchase so controversial, and who will it affect most?
This was controversial because the Justice Department decided that the merger of these two companies would harm consumers. And the rationale was that it would give AT&T an unfair position in the marketplace if it could control what HBO does, or the output of the Turner networks, or CNN, or Warner Brothers. And, you know, a lot of people think also that Donald Trump just doesn't like CNN and wanted to give them a hard time.
Right.
That probably was a factor.
Probably,
But, you know, this is a vertical merger where it's different companies within a chain. They're not direct competitors. The Disney and Comcast bids for Fox, that would be a horizontal merger.
Right.
That would take one competitor out of the market.
Right.
But that wasn't the case with AT&T, and the judge ruled that it was fine for them to buy Time Warner. Now they have the challenge of merging these two companies.
And this was really a total victory for media and media mergers, right? I mean, here, a lot of people thought that the judge might require AT&T to divest itself of DirecTV or require Time Warner to divest itself of CNN. In the end, nobody had to really do anything.
Yeah, it was a huge victory for AT&T and Time Warner, and it is just opening the floodgates now to this, what we expect will be a wave of mergers and consolidations within the industry over the next couple of years.
Like Sony, MGM, Lionsgate, AMC, Networks, Discovery Communications, they've all been rumored, right, to be in the mix here for this.
Absolutely.
Kind of—
various scenarios where different companies might merge. There may be a buyer, who knows? You know, Apple could buy a studio, YouTube or Google could buy a studio. Some of these smaller entities could merge. Everybody's trying to get bigger and to bulk up for this digital future where everybody's a content player.
And it, I guess for consumers, the fear is that there will be higher prices, fewer choices, but we'll have to wait and see.
Well, and the creative community fears that there may be. There's been this boom by Netflix pumping billions of dollars into the content industry, and the fear is that that gravy train is going to end and there will be fewer buyers for shows and movies.
Right. One last thing that we've just learned about today is that Apple and Oprah are going into business together. The terms are not yet public, but Oprah will continue to serve as the chairman and CEO of her Discovery-backed cable network OWN, with which she expanded her deal in December all the way through 2025. And Oprah's Harpo Films will own any and all content produced under the Apple partnership. So what exactly is Apple getting here?
Well, they're getting Oprah. They're getting a gigantic press release. This is exactly what we've been talking about. There's this gold rush for talent right now, and all these companies are throwing hundreds of millions of dollars at different talent. And this is a crown jewel. To say you're in business with Oprah Winfrey is, you know, something that Netflix and Amazon and all the traditional companies can't say, and now Apple can say it. It is unclear what exactly she's going to be doing at Apple as opposed to what she has done on OWN. And I think Discovery, as her investor in OWN, is going to benefit, because if Harpo is producing these shows, then they will benefit. But, you know, it's a big coup, and it's another example of just the war for talent that's going on right now.
Which, again, as you started to reference, Ryan Murphy and Shonda Rhimes to Netflix, Greg Berlanti to Warner Brothers TV. These are deals worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Hard to imagine Oprah isn't getting that kind of money as well, probably more, and maybe others to follow. So we'll keep an eye on that. And Matt Bellany, thanks for joining us.
Great. Thank you.
And now for my interview with Claire Danes. Over the course of our conversation at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter, the 39-year-old and I discussed a wide range of topics, among them how she found her way into the business at such a young age, how she landed My So-Called Life, and how her life and career changed as a result of that short-lived show, what she learned from her subsequent experiences on film sets with the likes of Winona Ryder and Jodie Foster, and why, a year after Romeo and Juliet, she passed on a chance to star opposite Leonardo DiCaprio again in another little film called Titanic, why she decided to leave the business just as her career was really taking off to study at Yale University, why she returned to the business before graduating, and what it was like for her trying to figure out her place in the business as an adult, why, for nearly a year after the triumph of Temple Grandin, she felt deeply hurt about the lack of quality opportunities coming her way, and why, at that low point, she decided to become a regular on a TV series again for the first time in more than 16 years, what she has found most fascinating and challenging about playing Carrie Matheson over the last 7 years on a show that has been eerily prescient about a lot of real-world problems and solutions, plus much more. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation. All right, Claire, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. We always begin on this podcast with some basics. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born in Roosevelt Hospital on the island of Manhattan, yes, in New York City in 1979. I grew up on Crosby Street, mm-hmm, in Soho. Mm-hmm. My parents were artists. They met at RISD, Rhode Island School of Design. But when I came around, my dad was a contractor for 20 years, and my mom ran a toddler school she was a textile designer, uh-huh, and then she ran a toddler school in our loft called Crosby Kids. Uh-huh. So I cohabitated basically with
a lot of
1 and 2-year-olds. There were cubbies in the entryway,
right,
and things, just raisins everywhere and diluted apple juice,
right,
in the refrigerator. So yeah, and that's what they did. And
yep,
then I dragged them out to LA when I became this odd kid actor.
Right.
And they've stayed. So now they're in Santa Monica.
Nice. Went back.
And I moved back as, right, soon as I could, but I stay with them when I'm here.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, the way I read it, trying to go back and find things even from when you were just starting out, which was interesting because there's some interview magazine and different things that,
right,
were on you very early on.
Yeah.
It sounds like it really, we owe it to Madonna for you being here. Is that right?
It's true. I guess she was my initial inspiration. I think she probably was for a lot, mm-hmm, of people in my generation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw her on television when I was about 5, and it just registered that performing could be one's job,
mm-hmm,
and that seemed very appealing. But I do remember, like, the television was in my parents' room,
mm-hmm,
and I shot up on the bed and I started bouncing on it because I had this, you know, this epiphany. And it took me a little while to kind of differentiate acting specifically from just being on stage,
right.
In a general sense, and kind of dancing around.
Well, I see you also sounds like you had a very vivid imagination. Did this cause some, you know, as early as six, you had to deal with this a little bit, right?
Yeah, no, I knew I wanted to be an actor from that point on. I had danced from the age of four on, so.
But what I mean, I guess not to, if it, you know, what I had seen, maybe, again, there's some bullshit out there, but this, did you have, like, imaginary friends or things like that?
Oh, yeah. I had to go to therapy when I was six because I saw creatures. There was a gargoyle that lived in on the pipes, the ceiling of my loft, and, like, would make me do things. And I couldn't take a shower alone because I was convinced that, like, demons were coming out of the shower. I mean, it got kind of intense. But I think that was just a kind of perverse expression of having imaginary friends. And when I finally saw this therapist, he asked me if, could I anticipate seeing them? You know, was it something that I had some control over that I would make manifest in my imagination? And I had to admit that was probably true. So if I could make them appear, I could also make them go away.
Right.
And I also realized if I was in therapy that I might have a problem, and that kind of, that was enough to resolve it ultimately.
So how did dance, which, as you say, you started at such a young age, how did that give way to acting at also a very young age?
Well, I had a really wonderful teacher, Ellen Robbins, who I still see in the neighborhood on occasion, and she's still teaching. I just saw Maggie Gyllenhaal at some photo shoot, and her daughter goes to her class, Julianne Moore sends her daughter to her class. It's kind of amazing. She was great in that, even at the age of four, she took me and every other one of her students, you know, very seriously, and we were asked to choreograph our own piece and choose our own music and our own theme and our costume. And so I think that was very encouraging and edifying. And then people would come looking for talent at her, you know, in the class. And I tend to be kind of hammy and conspicuous and would often get chosen. So had some experience performing something like professionally, La Mama or PS 122, you know, these theaters mostly in the Lower East Side in New York. And, you know, so had a taste of what that was like and responded very positively to it.
Well, how does somebody at 12 get an agent?
Well, I started taking acting classes at Lee Strasberg when I was 10 and loved that and took it very seriously.
You were method early.
Oh, yeah. I was desperately trying to feel that wind.
Right.
And then I found a junior high school, new junior high school called PPAS, Professional Performing Arts School. And I went in its first year of existence and met some other kids who were working professionally and kind of figured out what an agent was and how to get one. And my dad had been a photographer, and so we still had a dark room in our loft. And so a woman who was renting it at the time took my headshots, and we sent them out. And I got responses and had meetings. And I'd actually done a couple of student films. So my best friend at the time, and still my best friend to this day, Arielle. Her mom is a choreographer, and Arielle had been a dancer. I had danced with her mother, and I guess that's how she was chosen to be in a student film, and that same director was going to make another movie and was looking for another kid. So Tamar, Arielle's mom, who ended up kind of choreographing a piece that I did in my 20s, suggested me. So she served as my first agent, really. But so I had
That a thing where you Milos Forman was there?
Yes. Milos Forman was the teacher of the director who was making the student film, this graduate film for Columbia. So he was at my first audition.
That's unbelievable.
Isn't that wild?
So you were...
I was 11. 11.
Auditioning for
Milos. Yeah, I know. That was very outrageously fortunate. But yeah, I did that and just totally fell in love with the process. And also had something to show to these agents. So a woman called Karen Friedman at Writers and Artists took me on at 12. And that was it. And I would rollerblade from audition to audition and started kind of booking gigs.
Well, you must have been an interesting client because I heard the first offer you got was a no from you.
Yeah, I guess the first offer I got was for Days of Our Lives, and I turned it down because I was concerned that I was still unformed and malleable as an actor, and I didn't want to develop bad soapy habits.
But that's amazing for a 12-year-old to even think in those terms. Most people would be thrilled they just got a job.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know where I got that chutzpah, but yeah, and I kind of lost it along the way, that discernment.
Right.
But came back.
Well, so after initially, I guess these first jobs were all in New York. I know there was like a Law and Order episode and there were,
Duh, of course,
you got it. I mean, who doesn't? A pilot for a Dudley Moore sitcom, all this stuff. What is it that led to this really kind of fateful trip in December of 92 out to LA for the first time? Because what came of it is actually not what brought you out there, right?
I guess I had some experience of coming out to LA, coming close to getting jobs and going on screen tests, which was a very glamorous thing. And, you know, stretch limousines would arrive on our cobblestone Crosby Street. And my dad would take me out. I remember we kind of landed in some hotel in West Hollywood and kind of walked to some restaurant and realized that we were not, I don't know, that we like walked into a, you know, a very gay strip or something. It was a middle-aged man and his tiny daughter.
Right.
We felt very confused. But yeah, I guess I don't really remember. Actually, my dad, I am 39 years old, and my dad, I was staying with my folks out here in LA, drove me to and from my Soul Cycle class. And
you get the old habits that hard, yeah.
And as he was driving me home, he said, "Oh, yeah, that's where you auditioned for My So-Called Life."
Wow.
And I was like, oh, right.
Well, the reason I'm driving at is that, and maybe this is incorrect, but what I read was that the audition for My So-Called Life was actually just sort of an add-on when, in fact, you had come out here because Spielberg wanted to screen test you for Schindler's List.
I don't think that's right. I don't remember the circumstances of my auditioning for My So-Called Life. I think it was probably like those screen tests. I probably was called out because I had auditioned in New York in a way that was convincing. I could be getting this wrong. I'm going to see Winnie Holtzman for lunch tomorrow. She might have a clear memory of it.
She's the writer of the alter ego, right? Of your
character.
Yeah,
exactly. So we're still very close, but she might recall it in greater detail.
But Spielberg did want you for the...
He did. But I auditioned for that on tape, I think, in New York. I remember working on my Polish accent for that. But I kept being told I was the spirit of the movie, And basically, I was like kind of a glorified extra. And they weren't going to pay for a tutor, and I didn't want to
be... That was the issue. And just, if I had it correct here, it was to play the maid of the Ralph Fiennes character.
No. I would think it was like the girl in the red coat or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like not a real role or something like that.
Right. Well, okay, so anyway, you end up at the audition for My So-Called Life, which I guess we should also note was the team that was coming off of 30-something, right?
Right. Ed Zwick and Marshall Hershkovitz.
Yeah. And they'd been impressed from what I saw with your Law and Order episode, because what else did they have to go on at that point? So it basically came down to Alicia Silverstone, who was 3 years older than you, and you.
Yeah.
And it would have been easier to go with Alicia Silverstone, right? Because I guess hours that you can work with an actress.
Yeah, I think I was probably a real hindrance in that respect. Yeah, I was 13 when I did the pilot. And child labor laws are pretty strict for a good reason. But yeah, no, so
what do you remember
they took
about
that
the
liability on. About that audition?
Yeah.
I don't remember much. I remember just loving the script so much. It was like the diary entry of my dreams, you know? And it was obviously a good fit, you know? And I remember meeting Ed and Marshall and Winnie, and they were all really kind, kind of like my parents' friends, you know? They seemed familiar. And yeah, I'm just so glad that they took that risk on me, yeah.
Well, we should state for anyone who did not have the privilege of living through those days. This was 94 to 95. The show was on. You were playing Angela Chase, this girl who's dealing with all kinds of crap in high school. You had not yet even been to high school yourself.
No, not when I shot the pilot.
But you'd had, it sounds like,
I'd
your own share of
high
drama. Right.
Yeah.
Three, right?
I'd been to three junior highs, yeah.
Why was that?
I went to PPAS, and so PPAS went from, it added a high school onto its junior high school program really quickly, and it just kind of needed to meet a certain quota, and it was not so discriminating when it came to, you know, choosing the kids. So it was like LaGuardia rejects, right. And it just was in a kind of going through some growing pains, right. And so suddenly it wasn't the best school for me. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to the lab school, and I guess was there three junior highs? Maybe it was just those two. Mm-hmm. The lab school where I was in the same class with Marina Baccarin, who I would find
again in
Homeland and is one of my closest friends now.
So you guys knew each other at that time?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
We went to junior high school together.
Wow.
We're tortured by the same girl.
I read about it. So it was really like a bad bully of a girl?
There were three bullies, yes, mm-hmm. that I kept re-encountering. One in sixth grade, which I guess that was maybe that was the other junior high, you know, mm-hmm. it's cuspy. So, and then one again who at PPS, and then another one at the lab school. But there was this kind of archetypical person who just seemed to devote their life to making me really unhappy.
It was you specifically or just generally being?
Generally being awful. Yeah. I mean, Maureen and I still talk about this one person. My friend Arielle and I still talk about this mm-hmm. other person. Mm-hmm. But I think because I kept... My mom's response to that challenge was to just put me in another school. But mm-hmm. that I kept being the new girl and kept being vulnerable for that reason. And I think I just wasn't really good at junior high in that I was like a bull in a china shop with mm-hmm. all of those really rigid rules mm-hmm. that especially girls are supposed to observe mm-hmm. and conform to. And I didn't get the memo that you were supposed to dumb down. And I was just, you know, aggressively nerdy and an engaged student, to use a euphemism, right? But right. I was just like that girl with her hand eternally up. And I think I was probably pretty obnoxious. I got slapped around for it, I think. But Arielle, who I always cite, she only allowed herself to answer three questions per class. And she was very disciplined about remaining just invisible enough and, you know, ended up being valedictorian, but nobody would ever know. There was not a trace. And I was not so discreet, I guess.
I guess it gave you rich material for when you had to now play
this.
Yeah, you
know? Yeah. And I just thought it was horrible. I thought it was horrible. And, you know, and then Winnie just handed me this mic. Mm. You know, she was like my Sarah de Bergerac kind of thing. And I got to vent all of my frustrations in the most perfectly articulated way. So that was a massive gift, and I had a lot of rage to release. Then I was sort of ironically pulled from school. I was really good for me to go back to college and mm-hmm. learn that the girls especially do evolve you know, infinitely better versions of their junior high school selves.
Well, a few years before that, though, so when you first now land this part, it was obvious, it must have been, it felt like the biggest deal by far yet. How did your life practically change?
Well, I did the pilot and then it did not get picked up.
Oh, really?
So I went back to high school. But I had been working a little bit at this time, so I made my own money and I kind of mm-hmm. sent myself to a big fancy private school. So I went to Dalton for a semester. And then my so-called life did get picked up.
What changed?
I don't know, actually. Mm-hmm. I guess they revisited it and I don't remember, but that was confusing, mm-hmm. I guess in a great way. But so in the middle of my freshman year, I then went out to L.A.
Is that tough to be separated from
your
friends and all that? Or you remember it being exciting?
We were so confused. I mean, it kind of worked well for our family in that we were coincidentally, sort of at a natural fissure, and my dad's business was ending. My mom was kind of ready to move on mm-hmm. from her toddler school. My brother is 7 years older and was at college at this point. So we were kind of liberated in a way and available to this experience. But, you know, so we landed in LA very disoriented and confused, and it was literally the day after that massive earthquake
Northridge
earthquake. So we missed the massive rumble, but we were there for all of the aftershocks,
oh,
and
weird.
Everybody was ashen. Yeah. You know, everybody was just in this, you know, had been traumatized. And we showed up. And it was just, it was too apt of a metaphor for, you know, we were already felt that way. And then the earth was literally shaking. So I remember we were so naive. It was, and we just kind of let it wash over us. And I think we were so lucky to have stepped into such a wonderful culture, you know, a version of Hollywood with Ed and Marshall and Winnie, you know, who were so kind of responsible and upstanding. And
but when you stepped out of that bubble, once the show got ordered to series and it was going and finding, you know, maybe not a massive audience, but the people who watched it loved it, how did your actual day-to-day life outside of the bubble of making a change? Because, I mean, yeah, today with smartphones and stuff, it gets crazy, but I'm sure it was not easy at the time.
I guess. I mean, I was still going to high school. I was mostly tutored.
Okay.
You know, so I started working a lot after that. Mm-hmm. You know, it got canceled, and then I did quite a few movies. Yeah. So kind of hopped from set to set and would occasionally drop into the one school that would accept me here in Los Angeles was Lycée Français. You know, in New York, a kid actor seemed kind of exotic and impressive, but here in LA, we're a dime a dozen, and every school knows how much of a pain in the ass we are and how disruptive we are. So the really good school, whatever. So, but it was just so weird. I felt a little freakish. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You were enjoying the job aspect of it enough.
Working all the time. Yeah. I didn't have much of a life. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't think I really felt the impact of suddenly being famous. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I was mostly on set where that's not so meaningful or relevant, you know.
Well, with my so-called life, I mean, I want to try to see if you've figured out why it only was there for 19 episodes over 9 months or whatever it was. I think about that. I know ABC, I think, was putting it on at 8 o'clock, and up against, at one point I saw, I think it was Mad About You, at one point it was the first season of Friends. That can't have, you know.
I have no idea. I think.
Were you shielded from all the, did you know that the show was in trouble?
Yeah, I knew that the show was in trouble. But yeah, I think it was, one of my favorite quotes is that David Bowie quote, it doesn't matter who does it first, it matters who does it second. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was probably just a little too ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of shows that followed it that really did kind of land, that were very, I think, were heavily influenced by it.
For sure.
So, you know, it was a provocative show. It was, I mean, it was kind of amazing that it was, that it ever aired on the in the first place.
A young female perspective.
Yeah. And
well, it definitely, I mean, I'm sure you hear it every day, that it really touched people who did watch it. And I don't know if it was maybe the voiceover aspect where people actually felt you were almost confiding in them or whatever it was. But
yeah, I'm amazed by its endurance and the extent of its afterlife. I'm amazed and moved by it, really. And people who grew up with the show are now sharing it with their teenagers. Mm-hmm. And it has proven to, you know, continue to speak to current generations, and it's kind of timeless, which is, you know, what how lucky are we to have made something like that? That's always the hope.
Well, I wonder if we can tick off some of the projects you did between the cancellation and then going off to college. Just a couple of notes about each of them, just to see if you have anything you want to add. Little Women, I think, was maybe the first one after.
That was the first, yeah.
And it's you and Winona, right? Uh-huh. You're the slowly dying sister.
Beth.
But people.
Saintly Beth.
Yeah, Saintly Beth. And I mean, the scene, though, that I saw, if you go back and look at reviews and things that were written at the time, people, the scene where you realize you've been given this piano for Christmas, people were very impressed with how you handled that.
Yeah, I remember talking to my dad about that scene at the time, kind of wrestling with it, and trying to think about how I would play it. And I guess my dad was around, and well, I was doing my homework with the scene.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe, I don't remember what I asked exactly. Something, I guess, why does she have this response to this gift? And my dad said, she realizes that she's loved. and it makes me cry thinking it was just so right. And that really helped.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
My dad directed me in that moment. Yeah, so I remember that. That's my dad's fault.
That's great. Well, a year later, 95, Home for the Holidays, you are Holly Hunter's teenage daughter. Mm-hmm. And I guess the big thing here was the director was Jodie Foster. Right?
Yeah. I remember going to meet her for the first time to audition. And I just come from set from A So-Called Life, and I was apologizing because I had a face full of makeup and was sort of embarrassed by that. And she said, "That's so funny. I used to be so embarrassed by that too." And she also went to Louis et Francais, and I think that she just, there was a clear parallel there. And she was such a cool, impressive person and a kind of wonderful mentor to have had in that moment.
The year after that, 96, a little small part, Juliet in Romeo and Juliet for Baz Luhrmann. Leonardo DiCaprio, who I believe was cast before you, has said in one of these interviews back then that you were the only actress who looked at him in the eyes during the audition. Do you remember him saying that? I guess he was intimidating even pre-Titanic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was such an amazing experience. I mean, just Baz is a really unusual filmmaker, unusually gifted, you know, a real visionary, an auteur. There aren't many of those on the planet. And his interpretation of that story was so radical and so beautiful and was really all about making it grounded and accessible and clear. And I happened to be an actor, I guess, who could help serve that.
Yeah.
So,
but doing like the balcony scene at 16 or something, that must have been intimidating.
Yeah, I guess so. It was. But I it was fantastic. I mean, the writing was pretty good.
But as a result of that movie, now I guess you were seen for the first time as a movie star too, right? I mean, this put you on the map internationally. I read that maybe as a result of that, you were the first choice for the part of Rose in Titanic a year later. Is that true?
I don't know if that's true. I mean, yes, I was definitely in contention for that, but I just filmed Romeo and Juliet in Mexico City. Titanic was going to be filmed in Mexico again for another 5 months or something with Leo, another romantic epic. I think I just couldn't repeat that experience so immediately. And I think I wanted to, you know, experiment with maybe different styles of storytelling
or
different locations. I don't know. Do I regret that? No, I don't.
No, it would have been a totally different career.
Yeah. I remember when, because Leo and I had the same manager at the time, and I was on a balcony, I remember, and he was kind of riding in a red convertible.
Leo.
He rented some car. His name was Zippy Car. And he threw his hands up and he said, I'm doing it. You know, he just agreed to do the Titanic. And I was like, you know, good for you. But I think it was one of those choices, you know, that I think he knew what it would mean for him. And maybe there was part of me that knew what it might mean for me. And I don't think I was ready.
Yeah. And I mean, even Kate Winslet, who ended up playing the part, has said that I think for a number of years it made it impossible to do certain things that she wanted to do.
Right.
It's so.
Yeah. I mean, not to be trite, but I don't really think everything happens for a reason, but that was not my course.
Yeah.
I think I just kind of had more growing up to do.
Yep. And if you had done that, you would not have been able to do, a year after Romeo and Juliet, The Rainmaker for Coppola.
Right. I did The Rainmaker. I did a little turn on U-Turn and working with Oliver Stone. And I don't know, zipped around.
Was there ever, this one I wanted to check also because I don't know if it's correct, but there were some things that were saying you were in the mix for the part that ended up being the Oscar winner for Angelina in Girl Interrupted. Did you go out for that one?
No, Winona, I knew Winona from our time on Little Women together, and she was working on Girl Interrupted and gave me the book. I think she was interested in me being a part of it. But no, it wasn't for Angelina's role.
All right, so was it a tough call? Like, what went into the decision not long after that, I think, to go off to college? And I mean, the thing, we've talked to a number of people who had started young like you, and the thing that seems to keep coming up is, like, on the one hand, people are a little apprehensive because they don't know if they'll be able to return. Like, there's some fear that
I think I had some of that, mm-hmm. but I had always wanted to go to college, mm-hmm. and I think I was a little confused mm-hmm. about how to be a movie star mm-hmm. and an actor, mm-hmm. and I, as I said before, I had a lot of growing up to do, and I needed to kind of hang out with kids my own age mm-hmm. and explore my identity in a protected environment.
Was Jodie Foster a factor here? Because she had gone to
Yale. I think Jodie definitely encouraged me mm-hmm. to go to school, but so she was an influencer, mm-hmm. but she wasn't the sole yeah. reason why yeah, I yeah. went by any means. My grandfather had been the dean of art and architecture at Yale, mm-hmm. so that kind of hovered in my imagination, mm-hmm. and I was just really keen. I was really desperate to give that to myself, mm-hmm. and I'm really glad I did. Yeah. I mean, I didn't finish. 2 years seemed yeah. sufficient. Yeah. Like, I kind of
you got what you needed.
I got what I needed out yeah. of it. Yeah.
Were you able to have a kind of normal college experience while
totally.
You were there?
Yeah. yeah. I mean.
I'm from New Haven. People are...
Yeah, are you?
Yeah,
oh.
I feel like...
oh, yeah, I noticed your cell phone.
Yeah, is, yeah, right.
is New Haven.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I also had just bought a loft mm-hmm. that I was renovating. And so I would go home on the weekends to oversee the renovation of my loft. And, you know, there was that weirdness, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I felt like a normal right. student, but I probably
it's a little different.
Wasn't.
Right.
And was very involved with my boyfriend at the time and kind of felt married. And mm-hmm. I really felt like a mature student in some ways, like I was
well,
going
were.
Back to school.
Yeah.
And I had taken a year off, actually. I gave myself a gap year. Mm-hmm. I made Broke Down Palace during that. Mm-hmm. year. So I was even literally a year older,
yeah.
but I'd done a lot mm-hmm. already. So I was really there to learn.
Yeah.
I was very nerdy, even at Yale.
And you were totally focused on, there was no acting in between. When you were there?
I was there. I thought that I would make a movie during my summers.
Mm-hmm.
That was unrealistic. I kind of failed to realize how much work goes into getting work, and being at Yale was entirely consuming,
right.
and I wasn't available to take meetings
right.
or read scripts or anything. And movies are not, you know, they're fluid and messy, and the start date would be July 4th, and then it would drift into September, and, you know, so it just, that wasn't so tenable. I mean, but it was a good 3 years
mm-hmm.
when I really didn't do anything, not even totally intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
I'd hoped to pepper that time with some involvement, but it just didn't work out, and for whatever reason. And actually, I think that was probably fine and
yeah.
more than fine. I think it was valuable.
Does any part of you ever think maybe I'll finish this someday? Go back and finish the degree?
Nah.
No.
But
I think you're getting worse.
I know what college is,
right.
and I'm really glad for that.
Right.
And I kind of got the fundamentals
yep.
from it and didn't really need more for myself. But it was funny going back to work as an actor
mm-hmm.
because I was approaching it like a Yale student or something, and I kind of forgot mm-hmm. how kind of intuitive and visceral an exercise it is. So I was overthinking it for a while there.
Well, let's talk about the few years after you came back to acting, the projects preceding, I think, like what has to be a big turning point in your mind. I maybe not didn't have the immediate effect of being a turning point, but Temple Grandin.
Uh-huh.
So before that,
yeah.
The hours you're working with Meryl, I know she'd been like your hero forever,
totally.
Right?
Totally. I mean, yeah, it was a very modest role, but it was so much fun to get to play with her. Even.
And a movie that everybody saw because it was a Best Picture nominee
yeah,
and all that.
Yeah.
Hours was 2002, Stage Beauty 2004,
uh-huh.
about basically the rise of female actors mm-hmm. in England, 17th century.
Uh-huh.
I have read two conflicting statements that I wonder if you can sort out. You've said on the one hand it was one of your favorite parts, but on the other hand it was very frustrating because you got to basically play a bad actor.
Oh yeah, it wasn't frustrating, but it was surprisingly scary.
Yeah.
When I was doing those scenes where I had to act badly, I think there was part of me that was nervous about doing that too well.
They think you're just bad.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, 2005, I love this movie, Shop Girl, with Steve Martin. It just felt different than anything else before that, right?
That was a real joy. I'd read the book just because I, you know, was curious about it. Mm-hmm. That kind of felt like a diamond kind of falling from the sky. Mm-hmm. Steve Martin has been an idol of mine. You know, I'm not alone in this, mm-hmm. but, you know, for so long. And I thought it was very brave of him mm-hmm. to tell that story and represent himself in that light mm-hmm. and in that way. And I think it was such a shift in tone for yeah. him. And he was surprisingly vulnerable mm-hmm. within that context. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I felt very privileged to be asked to tell that story with him.
2 years after that, 2007, Evening, which is significant because you're not only reunited with Meryl, but from a personal yeah. standpoint, I think it was pretty important.
Yeah, that movie gave me the rest of my life.
Is Hugh Dancy?
Yeah, I worked with my husband, who mm-hmm. was not my husband at the time.
Right.
But yeah, Michael Cunningham, who wrote uh-huh. the screenplay, was our officiant at our wedding, and he became a best friend. And mm-hmm. Meryl Streep's daughter, Mamie yep. Gummer, was in the movie, and she became a best mm-hmm. friend. I mean, I didn't just get a husband. I got a lot of mm-hmm. very important people yeah. out of that one, and it felt quite magical. My parents met, you know, and we shot in Rhode Island, in Newport. My parents met in Rhode Island. He was joking the other day, we have to be very careful about Cyrus ever stepping foot in
going
that state.
So things were going along nicely enough with all these, you know, every year or two, a nice, generally indie movie. But would you have been content if things just kind of continued as they were going? Or were you kind of always craving something like a Temple Grandin, which ended up, this is a 2010 HBO movie that I think people looked at you with newfound appreciation after that?
Yeah, I remember I was offered that role, which mm-hmm. is, it's always surprising when somebody offers me anything. But Hugh and I were at the end of a really lavish, indulgent Mediterranean adventure. We had a summer kind of hopping from one outrageously beautiful place
Ischia,
to another.
Right?
We were, yeah, but I happened to be in Ischia at the time. There's
Pascal.
Yeah, Pascal. So, yeah, and it was just so, I don't know. Neither of us were working that summer, and we were like, right. you know what? Screw it. Let's just, like, have the best time ever. Mm-hmm. And we did. Mm-hmm. It was great. So I get this call to consider this story and this character in, you know, some 5-star hotel and Italy, you know, it was just so discordant with Temple.
And a livestock industry
exactly. Yes. So it was really hard for me to digest in that particular moment. I had only the faintest sense of her. Then, you know, I had to kind of do some investigating mm-hmm. and kind of figure out who she was before I could think about it more deeply. And it was terrifying. You know, it was absolutely terrifying.
First time playing a living person, real living person.
Yeah.
Obviously somebody who's got a affliction, I guess you could say, in a way that it could go wrong if you have to play it, right?
Oh, gosh. I remember we had filmed the movie and I watched, what was that movie? Oh, gosh, it's so good. With Ben Stiller and Robert Downey Jr. And it's like, what's that movie? You know it, you know it. Robert Downey Jr. does that amazing impression. They do that war movie. Tropic Thunder.
Oh, yeah.
Tropic Thunder. And Ben Stiller plays some like autistic person or something.
Yes.
Simple Jack, I think it was. And I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Did I just do Simple Frickin' Jack? You know, like, are people going to see it that way? Because is it going to be reduced to that in the public imagination? You know, I just suddenly had this real panic.
Well, do you remember what Downey's line is in there, I think? Or
What is it?
It's not very PC, but, like, you never go full retard.
Well, a Temple, I remember when I met with Temple, I spent a day with her and assailed her with questions. Mm-hmm. She was so lovely and gracious and totally open to all of them. But she, you know, she admitted that when she heard that I was doing the role, mm-hmm. she didn't have any sense of me. And so she looked me up online and found all of this vitriol, as one does when they go searching for anything online. And she said people were pretty suspicious. She said that somebody had said, "I don't think Claire Danes can play a retard."
Oh my God.
And she laughed. She thought that was so funny. But yeah, I don't know.
Well, I mean, if you had her confidence, what else really, like, did you need, I guess?
That's true. I mean, I don't know if I think her confidence grew over time, but it was uncharted and it was risky because, mm-hmm. again, our intentions could have been very garbled or misconstrued or miscommunicated.
Well, you had an interesting, and this is crazy. I don't know if I assume it's a coincidence, but like just shortly before you did this, your husband had done Adam,
yes,
about
isn't that
Asperger's.
Funny? Yeah. Yes. No. A year prior to my doing Temple, he had also played a person on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. We were both on the cover of Spectrum magazine
in the same year. What other couple can say that?
Yeah. But no, that was really helpful, mm-hmm. and all of the required reading was already on our bookshelves. And I would call him when I, you know, how did you do your stims? You know, self stimulation, mm-hmm. or, you know, what did you do for your panic attack? And it was very handy.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so for Temple Grandin, you got just, I think up to that point, as great notices and responses, anything you'd done, Golden Globe, Emmy, all of this. But I understand that the next couple of years, when you would think you're going to get a huge bounce out of something like that, were actually not satisfying for you. What happened?
Well, it's not something that you can be typecast as very easily, right? Like, let's get her for the next Temple. So I don't know. But it's true. It was an awkward period because I felt so stretched and so revived and robust as a performer. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt very alive, mm-hmm. and ready. And there just wasn't anything worthy of attaching myself, mm-hmm. to. And also, after having met that challenge, mm-hmm. creatively, I just had less patience for the girlfriend role, you know, and I just couldn't bring myself to do something two-dimensional. Mm-hmm. So I chose not to do anything at all, which was tough. It was kind of crushing after a certain point.
I had read at one point, did you actually, like, with any degree of seriousness, consider stopping acting altogether?
No, I never considered stopping acting, but I was just deeply frustrated. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard being an actor because we're dependent on so many other forces and factors and players. You know, we need original material to, mm-hmm. exist, and we need a producer to put those pieces together, and we need a director to hire. You know, it's like we don't have I think in these terms because my parents are artists, but no, we don't have a studio that we can go into every day. That's one reason why I love television, mm-hmm. is because I kind of do have the equivalent of a studio.
Yeah.
You know, I have a day job.
Yeah.
I love the regularity of it, the routine of it, the volume of it. I love just getting to do it over and over again. It's kind of the nice thing about being a lead on a project, mm-hmm. is that you kind of are afforded the time and opportunity to really relax into every moment. If you have a smaller role, each line becomes impossibly precious, mm-hmm. and then self-consciousness, mm-hmm. kicks in, and you know, so I like being in a flow.
Yeah. Well, it's ironic that right when you were going through this period, when you were saying, you know, post Temple Grandin, not feeling great about things, apparently it was the day after Temple Grandin aired, obviously unbeknownst to you, that Alex Gonza and Howard Gordon, who were coming off of 24, started writing Homeland the day after Temple Grandin, literally.
Oh, is that true?
They've said, and were writing it with you in mind. They were going to originally call the character Claire.
Yes, I knew that. But also, that is a credit to their imaginations and their vision, man, that they could go from Temple to Carrie Matheson, you know, that they could see some kind of thread there, or because I couldn't, you know, when they say that they wrote this character with me in mind, I still don't know how to take that to this day. I don't know if that's, it's exactly flattering, but
well, so how did they initially reach out to you about, obviously it's the pilot first, but how did that come about? And when it did, were you already in the headspace of, you know, going back to series television might not be a bad thing?
Well, that shift was starting to happen already, mm-hmm. where television was starting to become a place where you could tell, you know, surprisingly sophisticated stories. You know, Sopranos had been on, The Wire had been on, their precedents had been set. Mm-hmm. So it felt like there was opportunity there. But it was still kind of still nascent, I think. There was still some kind of stigma attached to television, although that was softening. But I was really intimidated by it. I read the pilot. It was, you know, undeniably great and incredibly arresting. And as soon as I finished it, I wanted to read the next one. I just didn't know if I wanted to do the next
for
one.
For seven years.
Because it was so much and she was under such duress and didn't seem like she would ever not be.
Right.
And I was nervous too about it talking so directly to, you know, what's happening in contemporary politics. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it was really so much about 9/11, and that was still quite raw. And I wasn't sure if it was teetering on something that on exploitation. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of concerns and questions. But I met with Alex and Howard, and they're, again, kind of like Ed and Marshall mm-hmm. and Winnie, you know, such decent, thoughtful, smart, responsible people. Mm-hmm. They just wouldn't be jerks about it.
You did have an alternative offer at the time, right?
Oh, yeah. I guess there was a chance of maybe playing the secretary to Leo's movie.
J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah. And I just thought, do I want to be the secretary or do I want to be the Hoover? I want to be the vacuum cleaner.
Right. Okay. So one of the things that I had wondered before I started prepping for this, I had known vaguely that when you were at Yale, I think you were studying psychology, right?
I was.
So I was thinking always maybe part of what drew you to Carrie was the focus on
absolutely, mental health issues. Absolutely it was. Yeah, that's always been.
But not initially, right? Because it wasn't in the pilot.
I can't actually remember. Oh, God.
I keep saying that. I can't remember. We're going way back here.
But
this might prod something just because I read that it actually, so in the pilot, you know, she was intense or whatever, but she wasn't bipolar.
And then that was Showtime's suggestion. Yeah.
And did that make it more or less appealing to you to now be playing?
I think it made it more appealing. Yeah. For sure. I've always been really curious about pathology. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think if I wasn't an actor, I would be in psychology somehow. Mm-hmm. My best friend is Ariel. Is a therapist, you know.
Take a shot.
I have a lot of and we talk about our work in similar ways, actually.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So the show pilot gets picked up, you now know that you're gonna have to get fully up to speed on what it means to be bipolar and all of this other stuff. Mm-hmm. Do it. First season starts, and it was a phenomenon right off the bat. I think it was the highest rated debut of a Showtime drama in 8 years, and they have had a lot of good shows. Did you realize during the making of it, though, that, you know, something special was going on? I think those first seasons, the chemistry with you and Damian was so interesting, Damian Lewis. So I guess I just wonder, like, did you have to see it to believe it, that it was really good, or did you know doing it?
I thought it was interesting, but my opinions and my impressions of what I'm making do not necessarily correlate with everybody else's.
Right.
But as I said, when I read that pilot, I was propelled further, you know, and I thought, I want more. Uh-huh. So I knew, you know, Alex and Howard can write a cliffhanger like no frickin' other. So I knew it had a chance of being popular. I think nobody could anticipate how popular. And I remember being, you know, really frightened and unsure, as we always are whenever we first start putting something together. And Michael Cuesta was our original producing director, and he was reassuring me. And I remember he'd worked on Dexter when it first started. Mm-hmm. And he was saying Michael C. Hall was also, you know, outrageously insecure in assembling that role. And I thought, oh, good, okay, good, good, good. I took real refuge in that. So,
well, you guys became the only Showtime show other than Dexter to ever get nominated for Best Drama Series. And at that first year, you won, Damian won, and the show won, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
that That is a pretty unbelievable endorsement.
Oh, it was totally. It was crazy. Crazy great. Mm-hmm. But that is rare and wonderful.
Yeah.
And,
you know. What's amazing is people would watch the show, I think, sometimes and think that is a pretty far-fetched plot line. And then 5 minutes later, the real world happens. And whether it's Bo Bergdahl, the Brody-esque situation there, and attacks in Europe, and obviously a president who doesn't necessarily coexist well with others.
Very diplomatically
Thank
stated.
You. I'm trying. Yeah. You know, I really don't look at my Twitter. It's not so. But it was interesting because what was the response in the intel community and even from certain presidents? Because they were among your biggest fans.
Right. Well, that's the best endorsement one could hope for.
Yeah.
Yeah. I credit our writers and primarily Alex, who is our intrepid leader, for being so thorough in their research. And I mean, they do let their imaginations roam, and obviously they take license, you know, creative license, poetic license, but sometimes they are surprised by their prescience, you know, the prescience of the show. And, you know, some of it is intentional and by design, and other moments are just seem to come from some deeper, darker, more mysterious place.
Well, and you would, though, each season, you guys, you included, would kind of do some background chats.
We have spy camp.
Spy camp.
Every year, one of our writers, Henry Brummell, who died a number of years ago now, but his dad was in the CIA, mm-hmm. and his cousin was a mentee of his father's and was also in the CIA and had retired fairly recently when we first mm-hmm. met him. And in his retirement, put together this week-long event. We go to a club, mm-hmm. like a spy club in Georgetown. We park ourselves there for days in a row from 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. and just interview people in the intelligence community and journalism and in politics. It's a pretty broad swathe of people. We Skyped with Snowden one year.
Wow.
You know, yeah. And we asked them what they're most frightened of, what's most relevant, what they think is going to manifest mm-hmm. in a year's time when the show airs. And that's really where the writers do their deep diving and find their raw material and have their imagination sparked. So that's a huge resource. Yeah. Yeah.
And what did Presidents Obama and Clinton have to say to you about the show?
Well, Obama apparently was a big fan. I don't know if he still is watching. Maybe he has a little more time to watch.
Right.
But
well, he was saying he was doing it in the Oval Office.
Yeah, that's, I mean, oh boy, cavelling hard.
Yeah.
But I don't think Trump is watching.
Yeah.
I don't think he's such a fan.
He's too busy with Fox News.
Yeah.
Okay, so not many shows kill off one of their main characters so early on and still survive and thrive. When that was introduced, when you saw that was going to happen, were you concerned?
That was always the intention. Brody was supposed to die at the end of the second season, mm-hmm. but the relationship proved to be so rich and, mm-hmm. you know, and we all loved Damien, so nobody wanted that to happen. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, that was the original plan, and the show kind of needed to grow through that.
Did you fear, though, any part of you that this could be a problem?
You know, I had real confidence in Alex and his team. So I think it was handled well, and it was interesting. I mean, to have Carrie suffer that loss, you know, and they took that seriously. I think they dove into it, even, you know, in his absence. Yeah. He was still very present.
And there were other
Franny.
People there. Yeah. You had other heartache. So no show pleases everyone. And there were certain seasons that were more well received than others. Now, though, this most recent season, people are like responding as if it was a rebirth or something that's had such a great response. Did you feel that doing it? What do you
mean? Well, again, I mean, I'm delighted.
Yeah.
I'm relieved. But, you know, I guess our third season was the one that was most knocked. Mm-hmm. And I quite liked that season. I liked a lot about that season.
Yeah.
So I'm not always in sync with the audience in their response to the show. But I'm so grateful that people are still watching and that everybody involved in the show is as motivated to, you know, work at this level. None of us have become complacent or fallen into bad stale habits. Mm-hmm. But I think the nature of the show is such that we're in a different location every year. We're working with a different crew. There are new cast members introduced. So there's a lot of creative circulation. And it's exhausting because we kind of have to reinvent the wheel every year. But it also means that there's something for us to actively reach for and explore. And so we're in a state of growth, you know. So, and I think that's unusual.
Yeah. Last three very brief things, if I can.
Sure.
Number one, this is silly, but I just have to ask you for your thoughts. There's a fascination that people have with what is called, quote unquote, Carrie's cry face.
Oh, yeah. I know that's like a thing.
What do you...
But I've had... My cry face has been... I remember in my so-called life, when you wrote a scene where Rayanne makes fun of Angela's cry face.
Really?
Which is, you know, just Claire's cry face. But yeah, I don't know. It's, I guess it's a thing. This is not something that I have worked on.
Cultivated.
No, this is just how I cry, folks.
I have no issues with it myself.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's expressive, yes. I guess.
No.
It's... I blame my dad. He has very rubbery features that I think I inherited.
Number two, are you still having fun doing it? I mean, it's now 8 years
in. Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so many years in. I am. I love our team. I love our little culture. Mm-hmm. It feels like I'm in a company, mm-hmm. and I do adore that aspect of it. And she's really dynamic, this Carrie person. So she doesn't get boring.
No.
And the writers, I think, do an incredible job of turning over all these other rocks within her. So, yeah, so far, so good in terms of my energy level.
Yeah, even while pregnant.
Yes,
which
twice
is,
now.
Twice, yeah, yeah.
Twice.
I mean, how do you do that? It's a pretty physical part.
It's not easy.
Yeah.
It's not easy. I mean, last time I was pregnant, I was filming until I was 8 months. But I wasn't filming during my first trimester. This time I was filming during my first trimester, uh-huh. which is a special kind of hell. So, yeah, I don't know. You just... When there isn't a choice.
Yeah, they power through.
Mm-hmm.
Last one is, we have heard that the show is ending after next season, the 8th. How do you hope, this is sort of multi-pronged here, but how do you hope Carrie's story will end personally? How do you feel about this chapter of your story coming to an end? And do you have any idea of what your life is going to look like after Homeland? You're leaving it with a very different place in the industry, I think, than you went into it with.
Yeah. Well, firstly, I have to kind of qualify that mm-hmm. and say that nobody's entirely sure if it is the final season. Mm-hmm. We think it is, mm-hmm. but that's not, an absolute mm-hmm. certainty. So there's that.
Mm-hmm.
But it will end eventually. And I don't know. It's really hard for me to visualize. I've emerged with maybe a different kind of status mm-hmm. in the industry, but I've also arrived at a different place in my life, and that I will have two children, mm-hmm. one of whom is now 5 and going to big boy school and has an agenda of his own,
right.
and that I kind of have to revolve around.
Right.
So I think those are a new set of demands, but I don't know. I can't say for sure.
Probably take a little time, right?
I'm going to need a minute.
Yeah.
I'm going to need to just reorient myself.
Right,
and
right.
It's going to be a big loss. I mean, I made this movie, A Kid Like Jake, with Jim Parsons, and that we shot last summer, and obviously he's working on The Big Bang Theory, uh-huh. has for a very long time. Uh-huh. They couldn't be more antithetical in some ways, those shows. But the experience of being held by an institution uh-huh. is the same. And we were both talking about how we're probably going to have to go to therapy or something, take formal active right. measures to cope with that transition
yeah.
because it'll be such a huge shift. But I feel, endlessly fortunate that I've had a chance to work on such quality material, so consistently, and form these working and personal relationships with this group of people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's corny, but it really does. It's this massive privilege. I don't take it for granted.
You guys do a great job, and I so appreciate you doing this.
Oh, thank you.
Congrats on the impending birth.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah. All right. Then.
Thanks.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Until next time, thanks for joining us.